Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki. I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Downs, international top-ranking, multi-award-winning services director for Microsoft in Southeast Asia and emerging markets. David, you have a remarkable history of success in a number of fields. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you for the time. I appreciate your interest. I hope I can offer some advice to people.
David, what triggered your initial interest in computing, leading to your studies in computing?
Well, I guess like many of our listeners, it was when I was a boy and growing up. I grew up in New Zealand, way at the bottom of the world, and really my parents bought me my first computer when I was fairly young. And I enjoyed programming. I just loved the idea that you could sit in front of a keyboard and make things happen. And it sort of blossomed from there.
I see. So you were sort of a passionate youngster in computing.
I wish I was passionate. I wish my skills matched my passion. I certainly apparently spent a lot of time in front of it, that's for sure.
Now, David, can you profile your prior roles leading up to your work with Microsoft and how they influence your work with Microsoft?
Sure. I guess I think of myself as having had a couple of different careers on the IT front. I set up my own small business and was a software developer and employed a bunch of software developers and really spent a lot of time working trying to understand how to develop good software for commercial organizations. I spent a bit of time working both in New Zealand and overseas in Dublin around about the time of the Celtic Tiger. Do you remember those times? The good old days before the dot-com boom. So that was kind of my one career, and that led me to my career at Microsoft. But I also feel I had another career, which was as a working in television and acting. For many years, I was working as a writer and an actor in television and indulging my interests in the performing arts.
Well, that's interesting, and I would imagine your acting background or communications background will help in communicating and messaging to your audiences today.
Yeah, I think so. A lot of people wonder if I'm still acting times at work, I'm not. But certainly communication is a key part of any role, and I think more importantly these days than ever, as we get so used to communicating via email and blogs and those sorts of things, in-person communication skills are becoming more scarce. So I feel that's one of the things I like to see as something I have to offer is communication skills.
Now, you talked about your roles leading up to your positions within Microsoft. Now, can you profile your prior roles with Microsoft and what key lessons you want to pass on?
Sure. I joined Microsoft 10 years ago, really wanted to understand what it was like to work for a large corporate. I had done many years working for small businesses and startup-type companies, but really wanted to understand what a corporate was like to work for. And I've been here now 10 years, really enjoy it, actually. Within Microsoft, I've spent quite a bit of time working in what we call the services division, enterprise services, which is around consulting, so helping organizations use Microsoft technology. That's been a core part of it. But I've also spent quite a bit of time in other roles. I enjoy kind of diversifying my interests. So I've done some time working in marketing and some time working in what we call customer experience, which is really understanding how the customers perceive and work with Microsoft. But really the core of my time here has been working in the services area, managing our relationships with large corporate customers.
So can you tell us more about your vision and objectives behind your current roles and then what you hope to accomplish in the future and how you will bring this about?
Yeah. So at the moment my role is I look after services business in Southeast Asia. And I come from New Zealand. I don't know if the people who are listening to this might know, but New Zealand is sort of geographically very isolated. I very recently moved into this role based in Singapore, right in the middle of Asia, in the heart of Asia, and I'm looking after Microsoft's relationships with customers, big customers, in about seven countries through Southeast Asia. Really interesting and diverse set of challenges for me personally, coming from New Zealand, which is quite a mature, if very small, market, to these countries which are, on the whole, not so mature, very emerging economies. My vision, really, and my challenge here is to take Microsoft's business and indeed the wider IT kind of story to the businesses in these countries in Southeast Asia and show them what IT can do to help enable their businesses, their countries, if you like, even their governments to achieve more with technology.
You know, you have this really interesting background, many successes. So can you profile some of your recognition and awards and how they were achieved?
Sure, thank you, and thanks for the compliment. I've been very lucky in my time at Microsoft. I've embraced the spirit of the organization. Microsoft is very much an organization that celebrates people who think outside the square and challenge sometimes the norms. And I've been lucky enough to benefit from that. I've won a couple of awards. The key one, I suppose, is Microsoft's Chairman's Award, which is an award given out by Bill Gates, which is quite a privilege. Celebrating success in role, and I won that a couple of years ago for some work that I did in New Zealand, helping the business there grow, and I was lucky to receive that award. But really, I mean, the key thing about that award, like all awards, is it's built on the successes of many individuals in the organisation. Just one person is lucky enough to receive the recognition.
You know, that must be quite a thrill to win an award from such an icon as Bill Gates.
It was, and it's interesting. One of the elements of the award was this watch, which I don't wear. I don't normally wear a watch, but on the back of it, it's got an engraving. It says 2DD, my initials, from BG, which is really neat. I have this vision of Bill Gates learning how to do engraving in his spare time and sort of sitting there and engraving the back of my watch. I'm sure he didn't, but that's the way I like to think about it.
That's a really interesting story. You're a very accomplished leader and manager. What specific tactics make for good leadership and management?
Well, I guess I come back to, I've been a manager at Microsoft for 10 years, and I've been lucky enough to go on a lot of training, a lot of really good leadership experiences. But it all boils down to one comment was made to me very early in my management career at Microsoft, which I remember and come back to a lot. And it was by a very good manager that I respected, and he stood up in front of an audience and he said, "I've discovered the secret to people management." We're all sort of listening and, you know, leaning intently forward. He said, "If you want people to think that you care, you have to care." And it was really a true comment. You know, the many courses and books teach you how to appear to be a good manager, etc. But what he was saying is it has to come from the heart, from your own personal values. And I guess I took that to heart. I don't know if I always live it every day. I hope I do, but I don't think I do. But the great managers and great leaders are the people who actually genuinely care about the people that work for them as individuals, as well as the business that they work for.
I see. So it sounds like you're saying that you really have to be authentic about how you deal with people, and that's including your customers.
Right. I think that word authentic has almost become a bit of a buzzword in business. And, you know, there are courses now you can go on authentic leadership. It's almost an oxymoron. You have to be taught to be authentic. You know, the really great leaders are the people you see who genuinely, it comes from the heart, from their own values. And I found it quite interesting when I first became a manager, how little of the training was around the business and how much of it was around yourself. You know, now 10 years later, I kind of see why that's the case, because the authentic nature of leadership is such that you really have to understand your own personal drivers before you can really lead other people.
Well, you know, this kind of leads naturally into the next question. You already talked about one attribute that makes for success. What I'm really interested in now is what other specific attributes make for success for the current roles you have with Microsoft.
Well, Microsoft is, like many corporations, is an interesting beast in that you're living in sort of two worlds, I always think. You're living in a world of needing to be quite close to the business results, understand in detail your organization, your business, your sales, your whatever the key metrics are for your part of the business. But at the same time, you have to have another eye on the future and the long term. And particularly in our industry, in IT, if we think short term constantly, we forget, you know, how quickly our industry changes. But if we focus long term all the time, we don't have a business in 6 months. I always think IT is a very difficult business because you have to have an eye on the short and the long term simultaneously and be able to almost seamlessly switch between them.
So you have to be agile.
Agile, yeah. Again, agile is another buzzword that seems to be floating around, but I think it really is the case. I mean, if you think about the average day in the IT industry, you're talking about cloud technologies, you're talking about the future of IT on one hand, on the other hand, you're talking about what's this month, this quarter, looking like in terms of our sales and our delivery and, you know, what our imperatives are. So it's definitely that flexibility to work in both modes.
You know, you've got this great career and you're being recognized within Microsoft. You're known as a leader. You're known as a high-performance individual and really a role model to many out there. So for computing professionals who want to work with Microsoft or work in Microsoft, what attributes make for getting hired and being successful?
Well, and thank you for the compliments. I'm not sure I deserve them all, but thank you. I guess that when I think about being hired at Microsoft, certainly when I hire people, and I'm lucky enough to be in a position where I do hire, the key attribute I look for always is someone who has a high degree of self-awareness. And I know that's very fluffy to say, but the reality is many, many people, when they interview, they try and appear to be something they're not. They try and appear to be very intelligent, very accomplished, have never made a mistake. But I always love the people who are genuine in their awareness of their own abilities, both from a positive point of view, so they're not shy to talk about what they're good at, but they're also not shy to talk about their failings and what they learned from them. But to me, that's the number one attribute I always look for, is someone who really understands their own skills and abilities and can articulate them very well. Clearly, they have to have an appreciation and knowledge of our industry and our customers and those sorts of things, but really that soft skill of knowing your own skills and failings and where you need help, to me, just is a mark of someone who's moved, you know, to another level in their professional development.
Hey, I got to put you on the spot, David. You just talk about those sort of areas where you're weaker or where you have failings. What are your failings?
That's a tough one. I'll tell you what my boss would tell you, and I tell you, actually, I agree with it. I'm a very optimistic person. I live, you know, with a glass half full mentality, and most of the time I find that does me well. But every now and then I need to develop that sort of critical perspective, and maybe at times I'm missing that. So I guess my failing is sometimes that I'm overly optimistic.
Hey, that's not a bad failing, though.
Well, I'd like to think so too. I mean, I remembered having a job interview once, and the first question this person asked me, a senior executive at Microsoft, and the first question he asked me was, am I lucky? And I thought that was a very strange question to ask. But then later I reflected on it, and it was a really good thing, because it was a question about how I see myself. And I said, yeah, I am lucky. Yeah, I feel like I'm a lucky person. And he hired me, not because of that, I hope, but certainly that was one of the attributes that he looked for.
You know, there's this very famous coach in North America, long past now, but Vince Lombardi, and he said, luck, that's where preparation and opportunity meet.
That's right, yeah. 99% preparation, 1% luck, yeah.
You know, there's this thing called IP3, and I know you've heard of it. It's sort of a program to create a profession out of IT. So what does IFIP, this International Federation of Information Processing, it's a UN-founded, UNESCO-sanctioned body, and IP3, this program to launch a global profession in technology, what does that mean to you professionally?
Well, I guess that's, you know, this is how you and I met, actually. I have a bit of a pet passion, which is around the professionalization of our industry. I find, you know, in many countries, and certainly New Zealand where I know best, but in other countries as well, that we really are our own worst enemy as a profession in terms of how we prepare ourselves and how we present ourselves to the rest of the professional organisations. And so I've been very keen to understand and work with organisations that are keen to grow the professional development of IT professionals. In New Zealand, I worked with the local New Zealand Computer Society, some talented people there, and I've started to grow that work in other parts of the world as well with IP3, really to understand how we can set in place a framework like other industries have and other professions have for certifying, for readiness, for training, so that we can really drive some more professionalism into our industry. So to me, it's really around putting in place that framework so that we can present our industry, our relatively new industry, with confidence, and so that customers and partners and other industries can look at us and see a level of professionalism that perhaps over the last few years has been growing.
You know, we're going to sort of extend that question then. What does this International Federation for Information Processing, as I mentioned, this UNESCO-sanctioned body, and IP3, which is the International Professional Practice Partnership Program, which is about professionalizing IT, what does this mean to then countries and their development?
Yeah, well, the maybe a good way for me to answer that is by way of an example that's pretty relevant to me at the moment. I won't name the particular country, but part of my role in Microsoft is working with some smaller and emerging economies and countries. And as part of that, I was working with the government of one particular country in Southeast Asia who expressed to me a desire to grow their overall professionalism and skills in IT. And I reached out to some contacts I had who put me in touch very quickly with IP3 and been lucky now to introduce to this country the concept of this worldwide body who has a set of knowledge, a body of knowledge, who has a way of doing things, who has some experience in helping to build an ICT kind of knowledge profession within countries. And that's been quite a revelation to me to see how generous with their time in IT, this, you know, IP3 is in particular, but also how much impact it can have in a short amount of time. I mean, we're starting to look at how we influence, for example, the curricula at tertiary institutes, the certification of professionals in the country, and how the government can then use that in their greater goal of growing their IT industry, growing their rankings in the United Nations rankings of IT literate countries. It's been amazing to me to see that sort of level of camaraderie across countries. And so I think for particular, you know, individual countries and economies who are hoping to grow, instead of having to do all of this work themselves, they can leverage off what's been happening in the rest of the world. I think that's fantastic to be in action.
You know, it kind of reminds me of this interview I did with this gentleman, Professor Brewer, and he won a major award, and he has this thing called the Brewer's Hypothesis, Wireless Hypothesis, which kind of says that if you, you know, enable technology in a country, and that technology has to be enabled by people, and really it's enabled better if you have qualified people, but if you enable technology, it actually increases GDP.
Great, yeah, I mean, it's a leverage point, and we talk about, again, another buzzword I'm bringing out, but leverage is a really important thing, and as these countries look at how they take a small economy and have some impact in the world, then the leverage they can get through a well-run IT economy. I mean, Singapore, where I live, now is a classic example of how to leverage, you know, zero natural resources, very little land mass, almost everything going against it, and they've leveraged, you know, information, intellectual property, and some very smart business acumen to become one of the world's leaders in business. It's quite amazing, and I think many countries look at that example of saying, how can we actually leapfrog some of the rest of the countries in the world and create some market influence ourselves?
You know, you've already answered this question somewhat with your example of working with one government, but I'm just thinking maybe we can expand that as well. How are you working with IFIP and IP3 to support your goals? And then an extension to that question, can you provide any other specific examples of initiatives you're working on now?
Yeah, well, I will expand a little bit more on that, because the IP3 and IFIP example is a good one, where I was amazed at how quickly I could get hold of some assistance for this particular economy. And we're, in fact, setting up a series of workshops in the country in the next couple of weeks. We will work with leaders in the industry, leaders in government, in policy making, in tertiary institute curricular development. And I've been able to pull in some overseas expertise to help that country, and especially just educating them on the information and what work that already exists that they can leverage. So, you know, I can see that will fast track by, you know, a year, if not 2 or 3 years, the work that they were already considering doing. I think there's also examples in other economies. I work quite a bit in Vietnam, for example. I haven't got specific examples there that I will call out to embarrass anyone. But in Vietnam is another interesting economy. Massive number of people, population, huge human capital. The work that they're doing there in terms of using their intellectual property to try and leapfrog initiatives so that they can actually get further up the scale in terms of readiness for IT, impact of IT on the country, etc., is quite amazing to watch up close. I've been lucky to be involved in a couple of initiatives there as well.
You know, David, you have your pulse on so much, so here's this sort of natural additional question, and sort of what is the link between IT and productivity?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I find this almost a conundrum, because there's definitely a link. However, that link can be taken for granted. I think that IT has an amazing impact on productivity, but only if used well, and only if there's a sustained and kind of conscious effort put into ensuring that it does actually have a positive impact. I think many economies, many countries, many individual companies even make the mistake of kind of, you know, buying a few computers, in inverted commas, put it crassly, and expecting that productivity will therefore come without thinking of the more holistic elements of, you know, workforce readiness, training, how they're going to leverage the spare time that's been created, how they're going to manage the knowledge that's being generated by this IT, etc. When countries or companies or individuals do that well, you know, it can have a hugely impact, a positive impact on productivity. But if the mistake is making of just putting in place a software package or putting in place a bunch of hardware or whatever it might be, without thinking of that more holistic picture, then actually it probably won't have the impact that's required. But behold, any organisation who's thinking about it, having a positive impact on productivity, to actually think more holistically about all the other aspects that they need to put in place as well.
And that's your area of expertise, right? You and your team, you can actually put in those frameworks or models to, you know, have that 30 or 40 or 50% increase in productivity.
Yeah, correct. Hopefully those sorts of numbers. I mean, quick advertisement, but certainly that's the case, is that my part of Microsoft is all about how we enable productive use of our technology. We see, unfortunately, far too many organizations who just buy a copy of X and install it or implement it without thinking of the more holistic things. And I would say at least 50% of my time on my team's time is talking about aspects of change management, of readiness, etc., not just technical, you know, implementation details. And I think that's kind of surprising, actually, to many people outside our industry to realize that their IT, and this is where coming back to IP3, one of the frameworks IP3 puts in place is really looking at a holistic view of the IT industry, not just the technical side of it. And it's surprising to many people outside of IT what other skills are required in terms of change management, training, you know, under skills, stakeholder management, risk management, all those sorts of things are very important parts of what we do every day.
So what are the best practices then for working in new developing markets?
Well, I wish I knew. I feel like I came into my current role hoping that I would understand those best practices and be able to develop them and use them immediately. But what appears to me to be the case is that every market is different, and every economy, every culture has its own variants and variations. There are some commonalities, and the commonalities appear, you know, seem to be things like that labor costs are cheaper, and therefore that has a perverse kind of impact on the economic value of productivity. Just going back to that example, it's interesting coming from a developed country and where, you know, most of the sales discussion is around driving increased productivity into the workforce, and going into these emerging markets, that's actually not their key priority. You know, people are relatively cheap. The productivity gains are not really what's of interest, of key interest to most economies or most companies. So that sort of changes your required discussion. But you know, there are commonalities like that, but then there are very, very different cultural, you know, social and economic norms as well in every country as well. So I wish I had a set of best practices, but I'm kind of developing them myself.
How does IT skills development contribute to economic development?
Well, I guess to me, I mean, that's the kind of the core the core premise for much of the work that we're doing, is we believe it does have an impact. And certainly in the countries that I deal with in Southeast Asia, many of whom are only, you know, 20 to 30 years into a democracy or into commercial kind of ways of working, it's interesting to see how quickly some of them have latched onto IT skills as a way to grow their economy, and how their skills development is a key part of that. But this one particular country that I pulled out earlier related to the work with IP3, these IT skills as being one of their top sort of three nationwide imperatives. They're a country with some but not a huge amount of natural resources, and they really want to understand how they can really jump up the OECD scale, and they see knowledge economies as a very key way of doing that. So it's interesting to see different approaches in different markets.
Well, David, now we're going to mine this career that you have, this really remarkable, tremendous career. And if you can share your top lessons about your, you know, from your career, things that you've learned that would be a benefit to the broader audience.
Well, okay, in no particular order, and thank you. It's sort of a daunting thing to try and do, actually, is to try and give out some pills of wisdom. One thing I think is a key lesson for me has always been people work and buy from and enjoy dealing with people. And so despite the fact that we work in an information technology age and we work in an industry that's very technology-focused, etc., fundamentally the values of being a person and being someone with reasonable IQ, EQ, someone who can understand the motivations of others and work well with others is still, and I hope it will always be, a fundamental part of how to work in any industry, including ours. So that's kind of a key thing. People work with people and make sure you develop your people skills. I guess another one is, again, sort of pertinent to our industry, is things change so fast that on one hand, you need to make sure that you're not daunted by the pace of change. And if you don't like, I say this to people half flippantly but half realistically, if you don't like the pace of change in our industry, you should go and work in a supermarket because things don't change as fast there. But change is just part of our industry. You know, things are constantly being undermined and paradigms are shifting all over the place all the time. So if you don't like change, you're in the wrong industry. So on one hand, you have to be willing to embrace it. And on the other hand, you have to kind of make sure that you're investing in your own readiness constantly. Again, ours is not a career where you can do a degree when you're 20 to 25 and then spend the rest of your career just sort of mining that degree. Ours is unfortunately an industry where you have to keep reinvesting in your own readiness and skills and awareness of technology and that sort of thing. And again, that's part of the whole nature of the industry that we work in. So that's another key lesson for me. And I guess the other thing, the other key point I would make, which I make to almost anyone that will listen to me, is the phone never rings, which is a euphemism for saying opportunity is really only there for people who put themselves in the way of opportunity. My current move to Singapore with my whole family, I've moved my family of three children and my wife, and we've left a very comfortable and successful and lovely life in New Zealand, a nice, very nice place to live. Come to live in Asia, which is a very, very different place. And the key reason we're doing it is to teach our children that opportunity is what you make it. You know, you need to put yourself out there and create opportunity. You sit at home in your comfortable lifestyle, the phone is not going to ring. People are not going to offer you new and exciting things to do. You have to create your own opportunity. That's probably my key lesson.
Okay, so I'm looking into the future, and I can see David Down, CEO, Microsoft, or CEO.
I think CEO would drive me a bit nuts, actually. It's a pretty tough job. The closer I get to those sorts of positions, the less I'm desiring them. I see how hard those guys work and, you know, how much it consumes their lives. And I guess I'm always trying to find the balance between my personal life and my work life. I don't think I've got it completely sorted, but I feel like I like to keep those things in balance a little bit more than the CEO can sometimes allow you to be.
Now, do you have any additional tips for IT professionals in terms of how they can be successful?
Yeah, I think, and this is not rehearsed, as you know, Stephen, but IT professionals need to understand that professionals, you know, it's a requirement. There's a requirement upon us, and I think it behoves anyone who's working in our industry to really invest in making sure that our industry is growing as a discipline, and that they are working on their professional skills, that they are growing the industry knowledge that we have, and that we don't put up with the fact that, you know, 9 out of 10 projects are late or go over budget or all those sorts of horrible sort of statistics that surround our industry. We need to invest in developing ourselves and therefore developing our industry so that we can be credible and relevant moving forward, because I think the industry that we belong to deserves more professional structure around it. So that's kind of a key thing for me is understanding how the professionals that work in our industry are continuing to help develop the industry they also work in.
You know, it's kind of like a natural segue again into this IFIP IP3.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I admire the work the organisation's doing. I hope to take more part in it myself. Certainly, I think it's horrifying when you dive behind some the statistics of our industry and you compare it with some others. I mean, IT as an industry has been around maybe depending on how you define it, maybe 30, maybe 50, maybe 60, 70 years. Compare that to engineering or law or, you know, any of the other professional disciplines. We're very, very young, and we have to do the same sort of level of rigor that's gone into those industries and professions to develop. And certainly, I admire the work that's been done in that area to get that professionalism indoctrinated and inculcated. And I think in 20 years' time, we'll find it very, very strange that people would ever hire an IT professional without a professional qualification or professional certification. I'd love to see that day come sooner rather than later.
Now I'm going to make you a seer, right? So you're going to look into the future and you're going to talk about your predictions and their implications and how we can prepare.
It's funny. I always think that people who predict the trends, particularly in ICT, always get the dimension wrong. One of the dimensions wrong, either the time dimension, so they think things are going to happen quicker or slower than they do, or the impact dimension, the things are going to have more impact. Right now, of course, the big buzz is around cloud computing and moving things into the cloud, et cetera, et cetera. And it appears, you know, we're sort of just on the other side of that wave, and we're now trying to understand, did we overcall, did we overpredict? So I think anyone who predicts IT more than about 5 years in the future is probably doomed for failure. But what I do know is I don't think that IT is fundamentally going to change the way that people interact in terms of dealing with other people. But what it will do is make things a lot more smooth, a lot more easy. It certainly narrows the world down and shortens the distance between people. And as long as we realise that what we're doing there is facilitating individuals doing business with each other, in my case, then and we don't lose sight of the fact that that's actually what our core role is to do, then I think we'll do well.
So what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
In our industry? I think there's a perception of our industry, which unfortunately is quite often true, but not always true, where we are unpredictable, we are unreliable, where we are not as professionally run. And I'm coming back to our kind of core point here about IP3 and the work done about professionalism. It is rather dismaying for someone who's kind of I did a computer science degree, and many of the listeners would have done those sorts of scientific kind of approach to our industry. And unfortunately, that sort of scientific approach doesn't necessarily translate into a commercial reality. So I think the key thing the key challenge that faces our industry is how to be predictable, how to be reliable, and so therefore that, you know, productivity and all the other benefits that we promise and that many times we deliver, but not always, become more natural consequences of what we do instead of failed projects, over budget implementations, etc.
David, we're going to put you on the spot again. I'm going to turn the tables and say, you know, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask and then what would be your answers?
Good Lord, I have to put myself in. Now I've got two jobs. I've got to do your job and my job. I guess the questions you've asked have been fantastic. Thank you, Stephen, for them. I guess I'm always curious to understand other people's perspectives and to understand their different worldviews. So I would be asking questions about the relevance of our industry in the broader economic spectrum. So understanding how IT has an impact on the economy, on organizations' ability to transact business, etc. That would be a key interest of mine. And again, we've talked a little bit about that, but I suppose the way I'd answer that is really talking a little bit about the impact, particularly in government. I see, you know, many governments around the world have embraced technology at different rates. But I'm very impressed, for example, living here in Singapore, with how IT and information systems, etc., is just a core part of how the government transacts with its citizens. To me, that's a really interesting lesson I'm going to take back to New Zealand, and how little little information technology implementations can have a big impact on everyone's daily life. So that's kind of one question I've answered. Gosh, in terms of other questions, you have put me on the spot.
Yeah, that's a great question and answer. So, you know, we come to the end of the interview. And is there any last words you want to say?
Well, I really appreciate, Stephen. I appreciate your time and the, as I understand and have researched, the alumni of your phone calls is a very illustrious group to be part of. So I'm really honoured to be talked to. But to me, you know, whatever words I can offer, I hope they're useful to people. I'm certainly willing to discuss and talk to people and contact people, anyone who wants to talk to me. I'm fascinated with our industry. I find it to be one of the most interesting and diverse parts of the business world at the moment. We have the ability to impact positively and negatively many of our many segments, many customers, many organisations, governments, etc. I hope I can have some positive impact in the part of the world that I'm now in. Looking forward to working with others to achieve some level of professionalism in our industry as well.
You know, David, you're having a substantial historical impact on the world today through your contributions and, you know, all of the work you have that has a societal and industry purpose and does have this sort of resonating significance and this kind of resounding impact, as I mentioned before. So just remarkable what you've done and what you're continuing to do. And you know, to follow your career, I think it'll be just a remarkable journey. You know, I know your schedule is really demanding. You've got a lot of accountability. So we are really fortunate you came in to do this interview. I want to thank you for sharing your substantial insights and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I appreciate your time and the time you've set aside to talk to me, and I hope it's been of interest and of some use. Thanks.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Downs, international top-ranking, multi-award-winning services director for Microsoft and Southeast Asia and emerging markets.